Welcome, everyone. For those of you that do not know me, my name is Eric Jorgensen. I am the founder of Special Needs Navigator. I started Special Needs Navigator to help families, individuals, and caregivers navigate the maze of benefits, resources, and services. Today, I have with me Matthew Bogan of Bogan Law. Matthew is an attorney licensed in DC, Virginia, and Maryland. And although we'll be talking about guardianship, none of this is meant to be legal advice. Matthew is not familiar with your situation or the state that you're in, even if you live in Maryland. Although he is an attorney, he is not your attorney. If you'd like to consult with him regarding guardianship or any other estate planning needs, his contact information will be at the last slide and will be included in the show notes. Matthew has been an attorney doing estate planning for many years. At least 20. He's very, very familiar with special needs law. And today we're going to focus on guardianship. In California, that's called conservatorship. It's the same thing. Conservatorship in Maryland and many other states does not mean the same thing. But when we're talking, if you live in California and hear us say guardianship, it's the same thing as conservatorship in California, just the way it goes. So I'm going to turn this over to let Matthew give a brief introduction about himself, and then we're going to roll into talking about what guardianship is, the responsibilities that a guardian has, and some things to take into consideration when you're gone. And Matthew will make sure I'm correct on this, but I don't believe that the guardianship ends when you die. It really depends on the individual who you are guardian of. I'm going to let Matt explain that in more detail. So with that introduction, Matt, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, Eric. It's always a pleasure to see you and have a conversation with you.
And Matt, you've been an attorney for many, many years, and you've seen a lot of changes. I mean, we were just talking about survivor benefit plan. Has there been changes in guardianship? Have you seen a change in guardianship?
Yes. So one thing to remember is while we're talking about mostly families who have a child in, where the child has special needs, in most jurisdictions, if not all, it's the same process for the other end. That is, older adults who are no longer able to either handle their financial affairs or make decisions about their health, safety, and welfare. At that end of the spectrum, there have been in many states, frankly, abuses where guardians or conservatorships or conservators, depending on the jurisdiction, have taken the individual's funds where they haven't provided enough oversight over their health, safety, and welfare. So there's been, as with everything, the pendulum has swung, and there have been attempts to make sure that those abuses don't occur. And so, as I said, it's the same process for everyone. People who have children turning 18 kind of get caught up in that. The courts have, it used to be guardianship, particularly again for older adults. You know, the judge would appoint his buddy to, or her buddy, to be the guardian or conservator. And the courts have kind of gone away from that and tried to regularize the process and supervise it more. And I sometimes have to explain to my clients whose children, you know, have been nonverbal their entire lives, and it seems obvious that they need someone to make decisions, why we have to go through the process. It's not intuitive, but that's the way it is. And so there've been a lot of changes in that, and there continue to be changes, particularly again, the baby boomers, of which I am one, are getting older and older, and there's going to be more and more people who need assistance. Again, it filters down to the children who are the people who are turning 18. Those are some of the changes I've seen.
Awesome. And this is, I probably should have led with this, but probably a good time to explain to those listening or watching what guardianship is, right?
Yeah. At its base, you know, in its basic form, it's a legal process in which the court finds that someone is either or both unable to take care of their, and I said, health, safety, and welfare. It's a little broader than that. And or they're assets and appoints someone to take care of those issues. That's at its most basic. Now, that means that the person and who goes by, the role goes by different names. Sometimes they're called respondents. In Maryland, they're called the alleged disabled person. Regardless, that person loses rights. And so the court wants to make sure that the process is followed scrupulously so that the it can be assured that it's doing, frankly, the right thing. And another misnomer, at least in some states, the court really is the guardian. And the person that we refer to as the guardian or conservator is really an agent of the court. So the court wants to make sure that someone who's carrying out the court's role is the right person.
So with that, and that's what I like to make sure people understand, if the court is the guardian, you take that out to the 30,000 foot view. And what that really means is the state, it really comes down to the state that you're in when you get guardianship, that it's the state's responsibility to care for that individual. And then if you were to move, like, so I'm my son's legal guardian. If I were to move from Maryland to Pennsylvania, if I understand it correctly, I would have to go through the process all over again. Is that?
Well, there is a uniform transfer of guardianship statute. You know, I don't know exactly. I don't practice in Pennsylvania, but in the jurisdictions in which I do practice. So it's a shorter process, and you file the guardianship order with the court, the new court, and the court reviews it, and then there's some procedural things that need to be done, and then the guardianship is transferred. But there really typically isn't an inquiry as to whether or not the person needs a guardian.
Okay.
That so it's not a full proceeding.
So with the full proceeding, you know, since the courts are deciding on whether or not this individual is capable of making their own decisions. And then you had said earlier, you had alluded to the courts would appoint somebody, you said a friend of the judge. What's that process like? What's the process like of getting guardianship? I'm not asking you to take me through filling out all the paperwork, submitting the paperwork, but what can people expect that maybe they don't know is coming or that may surprise them?
Well, I think two things. One is the amount of information you have to give the court about the individual's condition. So like I alluded to before, you know, the client whose child has never been, who's been nonverbal the whole life. Why can't I just say that? And why won't they take my word for it? Well, you need reports, you need documentation, and the amount varies from state to state. It's different between Maryland, the District of Columbia, and Virginia. But the principle is you got to give the court some information. And then the second thing that people aren't really aware of is that once they get appointed guardian, they still have to report to the court what they've done. So if they are just, I'm going to use Maryland as an example, but the principle applies everywhere. In Maryland, there's guardian of the person, guardian of the property, or both. So if the individual is just guardian of the person, there's a report that needs to be filed annually that basically lays out what the guardian has done, what the individual has done, what their care has been like, and those kinds of things. If they're guardian of the property, they have to file all these financial reports. And that's annually in the district. Annually in Maryland. In the District of Columbia, they have to file reports every 6 months. And nobody really thinks about that. And whether, and I'll leave other people to decide whether or not that's onerous, because the district was one of the jurisdictions where there was some difficulty with people who were being appointed guardian. So perhaps the pendulum has swung a little far, but you know, it certainly protects the disabled person.
If I'm understanding you correctly, Matt, it's not out of the realm of possibility for somebody to be legal guardian of their child, and maybe their spouse ends up having to take guardianship, become legal guardian of their spouse's father or mother or other parent, you know, or other relation because of the onset of Alzheimer's or some other disease or disorder where the individual, the aging individual has also lost the ability. So you have the individual who is nonverbal from birth seeking guardianship at 18, 19 years old. And then maybe you have your spouse who's seeking guardianship of an 80 or an 85 year old parent or other relative. I mean, that could happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely could happen. For what they refer to as the sandwich generation. Absolutely. And that gets to be a bit of work.
That's a good segue that it could be a bit of work, because what are the I think a lot of people, like you were saying, they don't understand how much work there is that, or how much reporting there's involved to the court. When you're somebody's legal guardian, what are those responsibilities like? I mean, I tell people all the time, it's not parenting 2.0, but what is it?
Well, I like to analogize it to being the parent of a child who's under 18. You're responsible for making all the decisions, but that doesn't mean that you can't exercise your discretion and let your 17-year-old do something that you think maybe is not the world's greatest idea, but isn't harmful, and so you let them. And similarly, when you're the guardian, it depends on, of course, the individual needs of the person for whom you're the guardian. But you don't have to exercise all your authority, or you can exercise all your authority. So you have to really, I have a lot of clients who are guardians and their children are living elsewhere in some kind of residential situation. So you gotta you don't have to supervise that, but you have to make sure everything's okay. You have to make sure that the caregivers know that you have the authority to make decisions, and they're not to make decisions for, if you will, your child. You are. And I had one situation where I got really pretty bent out of shape. I have a client who's the guardian for her daughter, and daughter's over 18. She had both some developmental issues as well as some emotional issues. And she went to one of her healthcare providers, and the child also had a history of running away and winding up in situations that could be generally difficult and dangerous. And she told the provider she didn't want to be on birth control anymore, and the provider discontinued it. No, that's wrong, right? Because the guardian, she doesn't get to make those decisions. The conflicts occur often with third parties. And that's when you have to really exert your authority.
And then with regards to third parties, if you're using an agency, because you're on the Medicaid waiver and you're using an agency to provide residential or day or vocational programs, it's important to your point then to make sure the agency knows you're the legal guardian as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are some agencies, if you will, that tell the parents they have to be the guardian, whether they want to or not. And then there's others that say, no, you shouldn't. And it's not for them to make that decision either way. It's an individualized situation for each person.
And I want to recap that, because if I heard you correctly, you don't have to be living in the same state as the individual that you're a guardian of.
Yes, you don't have to. That's correct. Is it easier? Probably. But no, you don't have to.
Right. I'm just thinking of parents that might be living in a current state, but when they retire, right, they've always wanted to move to another state.
And... Correct. Correct. But just because you're living in the other state doesn't, yes, you can be the guardian, but you're also responsible to the court that appointed you.
Okay. So if you got using our example, if you get guardianship in Maryland and you move to Virginia, your child stays in Maryland because they're receiving services from an agency in Maryland, you're responsible to the courts in Maryland.
Correct.
Okay. This is a question I get all the time. I'm sure you do as well. What happens when you die? I mean, not to put a finer point on it, but.
Well, the answer lawyers always give is it depends. But generally, if you're the guardian and you pass away, and the respondent or the ward or the alleged or the disabled person, however you want to refer to them, still needs a guardian, then someone has to, it behooves you to have made arrangements with somebody to step in as a successor guardian. Now, sometimes the courts will allow that to happen in the original proceedings, and sometimes they won't. Maryland's a good example. Everything's supposed to be uniform throughout the state, but there are some counties that will allow in the original proceeding a successor guardian to be appointed, and there are some that won't, under the theory of, well, you know, if it's 30 years from now, how do we know that this person's going to want to be the guardian? Which is not an invalid point. I mean, there's some substance to that. You know, it's a responsibility when you're the guardian, and you have to make sure that somebody's going to take care of the person for whom you're the guardian when you're gone.
So I've had people say, well, I don't have anybody else in my family. And, you know, Matt, you've known me a while. You know that case for me as well for a while there. What's their option? I mean, does the state just step in, or, I mean, do they have...
No, well, at least in these jurisdictions, no, the state does not step in. The state wants... it's really the local jurisdiction, and they really don't want to do it. But if that's the last alternative, then the court will appoint them. You know, the counties, particularly in Maryland, will step in when, particularly for an older adult, a 90-year-old who's lost their spouse and has no children. And, you know, then the county will reluctantly do it. You know, there's limited funds, limited resources, limited personnel. So they'd rather not.
Yeah. I mean, I know some states like Washington State actually has a whole infrastructure in place for people that want to be guardians.
Right.
You know, they have this huge infrastructure, but it sounds like the best thing a family can do or parents can do is identify somebody to step in when they're gone, be it a close friend or a trusted advisor, a trusted friend or trusted person, if nothing else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as with everything else, it's better if you make the arrangements than if somebody else makes the arrangements when you're gone. You know, it's the same thing with estate planning. You want to make sure that you take care of things and don't leave it for others. I mean, you may, you know, authorize others, but you want to make those decisions. You want to make sure things are done.
I don't know if we covered this in here in the beginning or not, but guardianship, it doesn't have to be permanent, right? I mean...
Correct. Guardianship is not a permanent, not necessarily a permanent status. And depending on the individual, you know, I had, you know, I have stories for everything, but I had one case where the child had she was 18. The individual had some emotional issues, not severe, but enough that she needed a guardian at least for a while. So she and her mother and the lawyers all agreed that we would have a guardian appointed for a limited period and then review it and decide whether, you know, she needed a guardian again and then for a limited period. So we went through two of the limited periods and then we terminated the guardianship. She had made enough progress that she no longer needed a guardian. So it's not necessarily a permanent proceeding. Some people for whom, you know it's going to be permanent, but that's not everyone.
No, I remember you and I having this discussion for me with my son, because I used to be very against guardianship. And then, you know, I'm seeing my son's progress and or lack thereof, you know, I ultimately decided to work with you to get guardianship. And, you know, part of that is just knowing that should he gain enough capability, I can step back. And if I remember the form I get every year from Maryland, there's even a checkbox on there asking me if he still continues to need a guardian. So the reason I'm bringing all this up is I want families to know it's not black and white. You do it, it's going to be that way forever. Because I think that might keep people from doing it.
Right. It's not forever. It can always be terminated. And there are two other points, one of which is just because, and I alluded to this before, just because you have the authority to make all the decisions doesn't mean you have to make all the decisions. And there are situations, there's some jurisdictions where there's what's called a limited guardianship. You can certainly do that in Maryland. My view on that is I would rather have people just be appointed the guardian and then leave it up to them to decide how much authority they're going to exercise rather than try and write a court order that says they can do X, Y, and Z, but they can only do A, B, and C if it's the first day of the month. I mean, I think it just gets too complicated. And then there's a couple other, depending on the jurisdiction, there are a couple other interesting wrinkles. In Virginia, if you have a guardian appointed for you, you can't vote unless the court order authorizes you. In Maryland, you can vote as long as you can cast the ballot. So there are nuances and differences between and among the states.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up voting, because that is another area where I've had a lot of parents tell me, express concern about, is they wanted their child to be able to vote, or, you know, things like that. So I'm glad you brought that up, that it depends on the state you live in. When should somebody start talking to an attorney or start thinking about guardianship?
Well, I think, if my memory serves me, in every state, an individual becomes an adult at 18. So I think it's probably, if you think your child needs a guardian and has demonstrated well for the first 17 years, it's probably appropriate to start talking around 17. Now, for example, in Virginia, there's a statute that says 6 months before the 18th birthday, you can file a petition for guardianship. I think that's great. Maryland doesn't have such a statute, and each of the counties has a different view on when you can file for guardianship. But certainly around the 17th birthday, it's time to at least inquire and figure out what you have to do. And also determine whether, in fact, your child needs a guardian.
Right. And then if you decide to go through the process, I've been very vocal on this. I think everybody should at the very least consult with an attorney, not try to do this on their own. Although, like any other proceeding, the documents are out there and you can try to do it by yourself. I'm not a fan, and I've been very clear about that. But regardless of whether you do it yourself or you hire an attorney to help you do it, the child is going to get an attorney appointed to look out for their best interest, right?
Yes. Well, that actually depends on the state. Just to pick on Maryland and Virginia as examples, in Maryland, the child gets an attorney appointed, and that attorney is supposed to represent the child. So if he says or she says, I don't want a guardian, that has to be the lawyer's position, regardless of whether or not the lawyer thinks that's accurate.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
In Virginia, for example, a guardian ad litem is appointed. So that person is not really the attorney for the child. The person is supposedly independent and appointed by the court to make a determination as to whether or not a guardian is warranted. And may take into consideration what the child wants, but that's not binding, as opposed to in Maryland, where if the child says, I don't want a guardian, that has to be the position relayed to the court. Now, of course, the court doesn't have to agree with that, but in some states, there's guardian ad litem. Some states get an attorney appointed for the child. So it's a subtle difference, but it's a big difference.
No, I didn't know that. I thought everybody was the guardian ad litem. So then what it comes down to, staying with Maryland, if the child says they don't want a guardian, and the attorney has to take that stance on behalf of the child, then it's up to the judge to look at the medical records and because I had to provide two statements, I had to provide two signed statements.
Well, right. The judge has to hold an evidentiary, a trial, actually.
Okay.
Or should hold a trial. Okay. Now, you know, sometimes the child says, I don't want a guardian, and there's no evidence. Just depends on the individual situation.
I'm telling you, Matt, this is... all the more reason to me why I would want an attorney in my corner.
I think so. I mean, it sounds a little self-serving, and there are people who can do it by themselves. And then there are people who have come to me after they couldn't do it by themselves. So it just, like everything else, it depends on the individual facts and circumstances.
And I have your contact information, and it's going to be on the, for those of you that are listening to this on the podcast and don't see the slides, it'll be in the show notes. We have your webpage, your email, and your phone number. Is the email the best way to reach you, Matt, or do you have a preference?
I don't have a preference. I'm happy any way people want to contact me. Probably email is the most efficient, but the telephone still works.
Yeah, I tend to tell people just email because, you know, I think, well, one, I don't answer my phone because of all the spammers, full transparency. But the other thing is oftentimes when I'm ready to do something or when something gets me to the point where, okay, I'm ready to take action, it's usually because it's keeping me up at night and I'm sending an email at like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right. Well, you know, there's always voicemail. So, and I do get calls from, I don't think I've ever gotten a call from someone at one, a voicemail from 1 or 2, but certainly 9 or 10 or 6:30 in the morning.
So I appreciate you making the time to talk today. And I want to make sure if people don't take anything else away from this interview, this discussion about guardianship, what one key point or two key points do you really want to make sure that they walk away understanding?
I think the first thing to understand is that there's no right solution for everyone. Just with, and I used to do a lot of work in education, it has to be an individualized determination. It's also not forever. And you have to be worried about third parties, and in particular, HIPAA and medical providers.
Yeah, that was the key thing for me. And it proved out because this year my son had his surgery to put the rod in his chest. This being recorded in 2020. Yeah, and I mean, like I was telling you before we started recording that, they wanted Children's Hospital in D.C. wanted to see a copy of the guardianship. And when we were talking to the doctor prior to the surgery, my son was just kind of going, yeah, hurry up. I just want to get out of the office. And, you know, for a surgery that involved, we need to know what the possible ramifications are, what the possible side effects are. So just rushing through, if I hadn't been his guardian, you know, he could have said, no, he didn't want the surgery. Or, you know, even if he had said, yes, I truly don't believe he understood the full impact of what he was agreeing to. So I definitely like the you know, what you have on there about the health, you know, the healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, for me and for many of my clients, that's what tips things over, because you're the guardian and you have the right to make decisions. And we haven't talked about alternatives, but there are, you know, documents called medical powers of attorney and various other things. And first of all, those can be revoked immediately. And second of all, again, I had a situation with Children's Hospital, like you did. They wanted a guardianship order. They didn't want anything less. So that's really kind of the tipping point.
Now, this has been awesome, Matt. Thank you. I'm sure I'll have you back on to talk about another topic with special needs. Again, for those of you that are watching or listening, Matthew's website is boganlaw.com. His email is matthew.bogan@boganlaw.com. Bogan is spelled B-O-G-I-N. Matthew has 2 T's. And these will all be available in the show notes. Matthew, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the ABCs of Disability Planning podcast. We invite your feedback and comments. Please feel free to leave a review wherever you are listening. And don't forget to hit like, follow, and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you would like to connect, please email me, eric@specialneedsnavigator.us. If you'd like to learn more about or talk with a guest, please reference the show notes to find the best way to reach them.